Max Starbow sat beside his campfire, alternately clenching and relaxing his left hand, testing the progress of the healing in his shoulder. Nancy Lindstrom had done a first-rate job in removing the bullet and cleaning the wound. It was coming along properly. In fact, it was well enough for Starbow to help the men build shelters, but he didn't let on to the others. Like a colony of ants, the settlers were digging caves along the river bluffs and shoring them up with lumber from the sawmill. Starbow was not a man to work for what he needed, a trait that had caused a great deal of speculation regarding the gruff man's presence in the train of settler families. He was well aware of their suspicions, and it served to amuse him as they labored to dig in for the winter. But these Christian folk had any notion of the circumstances that had led him to cross the mule train's path, they would have been horrified, and would certainly have sought to cast him out. A wicked smile creased his whiskered face as he recalled the day he happened upon Henry Dodson. Wanted for a shooting incident in a saloon in Bismarck, Starbow was traveling the back roads around the town Shank's mare. He was sufficiently tired and footsore from walking when he came upon a small farmhouse and a man attempting to raise one end of his porch. Seeing an opportunity to possibly gain a free meal, Starbow turned onto the path to the house and approached the porch.
It looks like you could use a hand, neighbor.
Henry Dodson slowly let up on the long pole he was using as a lever and stepped away to greet Starbow.
Oh, well, I reckon it would be a little bit easier if there was one man to raise the porch and another one to slide a rock under the corner.
Taking an additional step back to appraise the imposing stranger, Henry could not help a feeling of precaution. The man had the hard look of a road agent, combined with the size of a grizzly. He certainly did have the bulk, however, that met the qualifications called for to force the pole down and lift the porch.
I reckon the pilaster under this corner must have settled some. My wife's been after me to build it up. Says the porch is starting to tilt so bad she can't set her rocking chair straight.
Oh, well, let me grab a hold of that pole and you can slide a couple of rocks under it.
Starbow proceeded to take hold of the pole without waiting for Henry's response. With the leverage provided by the large tree limb, Starbow easily lifted the corner and held it while Henry placed one, then another flat rock on top of the porch supports.
Let her down now. Oh, mister, I'm much obliged to you.
Oh, 'twere nothing at all. Well, what kind of neighbors would we be if we couldn't give a man a hand once in a while?
I reckon you're right, friend. I don't recollect seeing you around here before. Where are you heading?
I'm heading to town. I had a little piece of bad luck. I had to shoot my horse a few miles back, but I'll buy me another one when I get to town.
Well, you ain't likely to get to town going the way you were heading. You need to go back to that crossroad about a quarter mile back the way you came. That'll take you to town. But it's a right far piece, especially for a man on foot.
Oh, now don't that make me feel like a fool. I reckon I'll just have to turn around and go back.
Oh, it's getting pretty late in the day to be setting out to town on foot. Why don't you stay here for the night? Least I can do is feed you some supper for stopping to help with the porch. And you're welcome to sleep in the barn. Start out fresh in the morning.
Well, I wouldn't want to put you out none.
Nonsense. We've got plenty, and you're welcome to share it with us.
Margaret Dodson had been listening to the conversation between her husband and the strange man.
This here's my wife.
Well, I'm pleased to meet you, ma'am. I thank you kindly for your offer. I'd be obliged.
She had been a little woman, not much bigger than Jake Simmons' daughter. Of course, she was a good bit older than Callie, but she put up a good fight. Starbow liked that. Hell, he'd had to hit her a half a dozen times with his fist before she succumbed. He could still picture her horrified face as he took her. and lying right beside the body of her husband, him with a bullet hole in the middle of his forehead. His only regret was that the woman lacked the fortitude to withstand that beating. He would have liked it if she hadn't died so soon. His reminiscing was interrupted then by the sight of Callie Simmons heading toward the river with a bucket in hand.
How's the shoulder coming along?
It's getting there, Bradley, but slow as hell. I still can't do much with it.
I was hoping to hear better than that. We're making good progress in most of the caves, but it would be good if you could get started on one for yourself. It'd be pretty rough passing the winter in that tent.
Oh, I might not have no choice. Still awful tender. I don't think I'll be much good for digging anytime soon.
Well, I reckon when some of us get finished, we can help you out.
Oh, well, I appreciate it, Lindstrom. Praise the Lord. I wonder where you got that money hid.
Starbow had been thinking about the $250 the party had promised to give Skinner at the completion of the journey. It was his guess that Bradley was most likely the one holding the cash. It was definitely something for him to speculate on while he was recovering from his wound. A moment later, the malicious grin faded from his face as he caught sight of Joe Fox approaching the banks of the river, leading one of his horses. The horse was pulling a travois carrying what appeared to be three antelope. Starbow glanced quickly around him to make sure no one was watching him. Then he slowly reached down and picked up his rifle. Pressing the butt against his wounded shoulder, he took deliberate aim at the tall figure astride the paint pony, his finger resting on the trigger.
Bang!
He lowered the weapon to the ground again, knowing that satisfaction would have to wait until spring. Unaware that he'd been framed in the sights of Starborough's rifle as he guided his horse down through the bluffs, the buckskin-clad rider halted his horses and dismounted. Dropping the paint's reins, he led the pack horse to a large fire before the caves, where most of the preparation of smoked meat was going on.
Oh, my stars!
Nancy Lindstrom saw the carcass on the travois.
More meat to fix? It's a wonder there's an animal left in this valley.
They're getting scarcer. I'm having to go farther to find them, but you're still going to need more to carry you folks through the winter.
The owner of the trading post, a man named Horace Templeton, stood next to the fire.
You're Joe Fox, ain't you?
I am.
Well, I'll be. Wait till I tell the boys over at the sawmill about this. I've heard some of the Indians talk about a man that roamed the high peaks, but I swear I never thought there really was one. Thought you were something they just made up, a spirit or something.
I'm Joe Fox, but I ain't no spirit.
Callie Simmons beamed delightedly.
He's not a spirit, he's an angel.
Joe Fox!
Nancy Lindstrom and Cora Simmons, who paused to listen to the comments, both turned a puzzled gaze toward the man who had volunteered to guide him to this valley.
Joe Fox, come on by my store, and I'll buy you a drink of whiskey, Joe Fox.
Thanks just the same, but I reckon I've got work to do.
Wasting no time, he led his horses away from the river as soon as the third antelope carcass was removed from the travois.
Well, now. What do you reckon got into him?
I guess he just prefers being left alone.
Smiling to herself, Callie Simmons studied the tall, rangy figure as he walked away toward a grassy knoll where his other horses were grazing with the mules. While Horace Templeton was relating the many stories he had heard about the ghost called Joe Fox to her mother and Nancy Lindstrom, Callie went unnoticed to her tent. Fetching a cup, she returned to the fire and filled it with coffee. Slipping a biscuit in her apron pocket, she then followed Joe to the knoll. Joe turned when he heard Callie coming up behind him, and he waited for her to speak.
I brought you some coffee. You look like you wanted some before Mr. Templeton started talking.
She reached into her pocket and produced the biscuit.
You might want something to go with the coffee. I hope it's still hot.
Thank you, miss. You're right, I did want some coffee, and that biscuit will go mighty good with it.
You don't have to call me miss. My name's Callie. If you don't mind, I'll sit down while you have your coffee, then I can take the cup back.
Not waiting for his reply, she seated herself on a cottonwood log.
You can sit beside me if you want. I won't bite you.
Joe smiled at that and sat down on the log next to her.
I hope that coffee's still hot. It doesn't take long to cool off in this weather. You haven't been digging a camp for yourself. Aren't you going to need a cave?
No, miss. I mean, Callie. I expect I'll make a camp back up in the hills.
Won't it get too cold to stay up in the mountains?
Well, it'll be cold all right. But not if you're used to it and know how to make your camp. I worry more about my horses than me. I expect I'll leave all but the paint down here with the mules.
Does that mean we won't see you again until spring?
I don't know. Maybe. I might drop in to see how you folks are faring.
Well, you'd be welcome if you decide to come back sooner.
Taking the opportunity to study him closely while he was seemingly relaxed, she noticed the finely chiseled features of his face and the dark eyes that seemed to be looking inside her thoughts. His black hair was long, worn in two braided strands that rested upon broad shoulders, giving him the bearing of a Blackfoot warrior. And yet his English was as refined as any of the men in her party. A white Indian, with his shirt and leggings of animal skins, and his bow strung on his back. She wondered whether his wants and passions were as feral as his appearance. Her mother would have been shocked to know the thoughts prodding her curiosity about this mystery man. Draining the last of his coffee, he stood up and handed her the cup.
I thank you, Miss Kelly. That was mighty fine.
You're welcome. You know, you're always welcome at our fire. After all, you are supplying almost all the meat for us this winter.
I'm obliged.
The day arrived near the end of September when Joe decided he had done all he could to ensure that the party of settlers would have enough to survive the winter. Now there was little time left to tend to his own needs. Taking only a small supply of the dried meat, some salt, a large sack of coffee beans, and at Callie's insistence, a sack of dried apples, he packed it all on the paint. Malcolm, Bradley, and Jake, along with many others of the community, gathered to see him off as he climbed aboard his horse.
We'll be looking to see you come spring.
Can't say for sure. You don't need me anymore anyway if that road you've been talking about really leads to Fort Walla Walla. I don't know much about the country on the other side of Lolo Pass, so I don't see how I'd be much help.
You'd be a hell of a lot of help, just like you've been so far. I don't know how these folks would have fared without you leading them here and supplying all that meat.
Joe nodded soberly to the folks gathered around his horse.
I'll be back for my horses anyway.
Joe glanced around to find Callie Simmons. She was watching him closely, a smile upon her young face. Their eyes met briefly, and he gave her a slight nod. She responded in kind. Then he abruptly turned the paint's head and was off. He left with a conflict of emotions raging in his brain. Never feeling at ease in a large gathering of people, he was relieved to be free of them. On the other hand, he was encountering emotions of melancholy that he was reluctant to attribute to parting from Callie Simmons. His meeting Callie had introduced a new sensation never experienced before, and he was not at all sure he was comfortable with it. She had stopped by his campfire several times in the weeks that followed her visit with coffee and a biscuit. Bright and cheerful, she had given no indication that these occasions were anything more than being friendly. He was not ready to admit it, even to himself. But there was little doubt that he'd come back. His horses were just an excuse to see her again.
Callie, you best be careful your eyeballs don't fall out.
Callie turned then to confront her mother's stern features glaring at her. and she realized that she'd been caught finally gazing after the tall scout.
Mama!
Your papa and me have tried to raise you to take your place in this world as a serious Christian woman. Marry a God-fearing husband and raise a family in the arms of the church.
Oh, Mama, Joe Fox and I are just friends. I'm not thinking about marrying him, for goodness sakes.
I saw you making sugar eyes at him. Who knows what a man like that would do if he had any idea you were sweet on him. Malcolm Lindstrom told Bradley and your papa that Joe Fox was raised in a Blackfoot Indian camp. Did you know that? A wild savage. I doubt if he even knows right from wrong. I pity the poor woman who takes him for a husband.
Mama, he's gone, and as you can see, he didn't grab me and carry me off into the woods.
Well, it wouldn't have surprised me if he had. You just think about what I said, young lady. You don't want to end up living like an Indian squaw.
Winter came in with a grudge that year, dumping heavy snowfall in the mountain passes, accompanied by howling winds that sculpted giant towers in the icy drifts that clogged even the oldest of trails. Although the valley was protected from the raging storms that stalked the mountains around it, still substantial mounds of snow covered the collection of caves along the river bluff. There was little activity in the congregation outside the earthen hovels beyond venturing out for firewood or answering nature's calls. The caves were warm enough, and more than a few felt obligated to thank Joe Fox for refusing to lead him off into the mountains. Unless the weather was unusually poor, Sunday services were held every week, and thanks were offered for the group's survival. Everyone made an effort to attend, except the sick and, of course, Starbo. Although apparently unable to venture out on a Sunday, it was noticed by all that the surly malcontent found a way to get to the trading post to trade items from his packs in exchange for whiskey. The rest of the time he stayed in his cave, glaring out at passerby as if blaming each one of them for the cruel conditions. His shoulder fully recovered soon after the men in the party finished his dwelling. All the members of the stranded mule train rapidly came to regard him as they might a great bear in his cave, and they were content to leave him to his solitary drinking. Near the end of February, the weather improved a bit, to the extent that more woodcutting parties could be organized, as well as occasional trips to Templeton's store to buy what staples he had left on his nearby bare shelves. On a day such as this, when the sky opened briefly to confirm that the sun did still reside over high mountains, Callie Simmons felt the need to venture out to flush her lungs with fresh, cold air. Stepping carefully through a patch of snow, she felt a strong urge to turn and gaze toward the western mountains. Her eyes settled upon a dark object standing out against the whiteness of the snow-covered hills. It attracted her attention because of its gentle swaying motion. At first, she thought it was a fir tree waving in the wind, but then she realized that the tree seemed to be moving toward her. Her curiosity completely captured then. She stared hard in an effort to identify the object, which now began to resemble a great bear approaching on its hind legs. She shaded her eyes with her hand as she continued to stare through the glare of the lightly swirling snow. Finally coming into focus, the object became a man on horseback, plodding across the snowy meadow wearing a heavy bearskin coat.
Joe Fox!
Callie could see that the carcass of some animal was riding behind the saddle. He never came empty-handed. Seeing her standing on the edge of the bluffs, Joe gave the paint a nudge in that direction, and the horse, needing no further guidance, headed straight for her.
Well, I see you're still here.
Where did you expect I'd be?
Why, nowhere else, I reckon. Looks like you're making it all right.
Joe reached back and patted the white-tailed deer carcass behind his saddle.
I ran across this young feller on the other side of that mountain back yonder. He was just begging to get shot, so I obliged him. Thought your family might could use a little fresh meat.
It would be wonderful. I'm about to turn into jerky. I declare, when you rode up, I thought you were a bear riding a horse.
I reckon a body could make that mistake. I'll tote this white tail over to your fire. I've already gutted him. I can hang him up and skin him for you.
They both turned to see Jake Simmons coming from the corral that had been built to contain the livestock.
Joe Fox is back!
Jake was successful in causing several more heads to pop out of various caves. One of them, Cora Simmons, frowned as she saw the tall mountain man, wrinkling her brow even more when she spotted Callie talking to him.
By golly, what are you doing back here? We didn't expect to see you before spring, and maybe not even then.
I moved my camp over to that line of ridges to the east of you, so I thought I'd drop in and see how you folks are faring the winter. Thought you might want a taste of fresh meat if you ain't been hunting lately.
Soon the entire camp was transformed from a sense of cold boredom into a festive air of celebration. One deer was hardly enough to satisfy the needs of 37 people for any length of time, but it was enough to provide one fresh hot meal for folks in need of something to break the monotony of winter. It was a good bit more than Joe had anticipated. He would have preferred to slip in quietly and lead the deer for Callie's family to use as they saw fit. Several of the men sat upon the carcass and hung it from a tree limb. Three men started skinning the deer at the same time. With knives flashing, it was a wonder to Joe that someone wasn't stabbed. He was about to step forward to criticize the method in which the hide was rolled back until a beaming Callie Simmons caught him by the elbow and drew him aside.
Let them do it. You've done your part. Now just sit down over there and watch these folks make fools of themselves, and I'll bring you a cup of coffee.
They're gonna ruin half that hide. Oh, well, I reckon it don't matter.
No, it doesn't matter. What matters is that you got everyone out of their holes, and people look happy again.
One soul was not enjoying the celebration. Starbo watched from afar. Near the end of the caves, where Bradley Lindstrom and Jake Simmons had dug their abodes, his mind was occupied with thoughts of the $250 that had been saved as final payments to Skinner. With everyone's attention drawn to the music, there would never be a better opportunity to slip into the caves and search for the money. Taking one last cautious look to make sure none in the crowd was looking his way, he left the mouth of his cave and ducked inside Bradley's cave. Pausing for a second to adjust his eyes to the gloom inside the tiny cavity, he glanced around until he spotted the saddle pack stacked against the back wall. Moving as fast as he could manage while trying not to leave evidence of his search, he untied pack after pack, rummaging through clothing and cooking utensils, household trinkets, personal pictures of relatives back east. Never one to hold his temper for long, he became more and more irritated as the search revealed nothing of value. His patience expired, and he threw the last pack carelessly against the wall of the cave.
Damn it.
He stalked toward the mouth of the cave when he caught a sight of a small wooden box stacked amid Nancy Lindstrom's pots and pans. He almost passed it by. Then he decided to take a quick glance since he had looked in everything else already.
Oh, I knew it. I knew it was here.
He took the roll of money out and fondled it covetously for a few minutes before returning it to its hiding place.
Well, I'll be back for you.
Outside again, he looked around him, satisfied that no one had bothered to look toward the cave. It would not do to take the money now. Even a man as blunt as Starbo knew that. He was content to wait until the weather improved and he was ready to part company with the unsuspecting pilgrim. There were a couple of other chores to be settled as well. He thought about evening the score with Jake Simmons and Joe Fox as he walked toward the party. There was also the issue of fresh roasted meat that he did not want to miss out on. Seated beside Joe, Callie sensed the sudden tension in his body. She looked up at him to discover the smile had been replaced by a frown. Following his gaze, she discovered the cause of his displeasure.
I wondered if fresh meat was going to rout the old bear out of his cave. Papa thinks he won't stay around when spring comes. Everyone's hoping he'll leave before then. But I ain't worried about him. He just likes to look mean. I think he's harmless.
I ain't so sure. That man's got a mean streak. I should have killed him when I had the chance. You be careful around that man.
Oh, I will.
Jake was in the midst of a conversation with Bradley and his brother Malcolm about the possibility of persuading Joe to join him in their journey to Oregon when Cora stepped up.
What is it, Cora?
I need to talk to you.
Jake let himself be led over to the side where she could speak privately.
Look yonder.
Cora nodded toward the other side of the clearing where Callie and Joe were talking. When Jake failed to respond as she expected, she spelled it out for him.
Our daughter is throwing herself at Joe Fox, and we've got to put a stop to it before something bad comes of it.
What bad are you talking about?
Jake! If we don't do something, Callie is going to follow that savage off to some teepee in the mountains somewhere, and we'll never see her again. Is that what you want for Callie? If you weren't so blind, you'd see that she's been mooning over him ever since he led us into this valley.
I swear. Well, what can we do about it? I can talk to her, I reckon.
I've already talked to her till I'm blue in the face. I think you'd best have a talk with Joe Fox. Let him know that Callie's not one of his little squaw women that can live in the woods.
Oh, I don't know, Cora. That man's done a hell of a lot for us, all of us. And I don't mind admitting that he probably saved my life when Starbo tried to trick me into a fight. Maybe you're seeing more to it than there really is.
I reckon I know my daughter well enough to know when she's thinking things she oughtn't. If we don't stop her, she's gonna do something she'll spend the rest of her life regretting. And there's no talking sense to her. I know, I've tried. You're gonna have to tell Joe Fox to go sniffing around somebody else's henhouse. I like the man too, Jake, but we have to think about what's best for Callie.
Yeah, I reckon you're right. We have to think of Callie. I'll go talk to Joe.
Although he had been offered the hospitality of Malcolm and Pete's cave in the Bluffs, Joe was thinking of staying in the cottonwoods upriver for a couple of days. Now that the festivities were winding down and people were returning to their caves, it was time to make his camp while there was still light. Cora Simmons had called for Callie to come help with some chore, leaving Joe by himself again. He picked up his paint's reins and led it toward the grove of trees.
Help! Hold up a minute, Joe.
Joe stopped and waited for Jake to catch up to him.
You heading out again?
Nope. Thought I'd stay around for a couple of days. I'm just gonna make my camp in the trees.
Oh.
Were you wanting something?
No. I mean, yeah. I need to talk to you about something. It's Callie. Callie's all me and Cora's got. We want her to be happy. Find a God-fearing husband when she's old enough and raise a Christian family out in Oregon with us. I ain't throwing off on you none, but I'm asking you to stay away from Callie.
Joe made no response right away, but Jake could see the hurt in his eyes when he suddenly realized what Jake was telling him. At that moment, he would have taken it back if he could have.
Like I said, we got nothing against you. It's what's best for Callie. That's what we have to think about. If you was in my shoes, you'd do the same thing. I mean, you live like an Injun. That ain't no fitting life for Callie. She ain't used to that.
I have not spoken to Callie of such things.
No, I know you ain't. I ain't saying you done anything wrong. I just wanted to say something before things got too far. Callie just ain't for you, that's all. I hope there ain't no hard feelings.
The message delivered, the two men stood silently facing each other for a long moment.
Is there anything else you want to tell me?
No. I reckon that's all I had to say. Like I said, I hope there ain't no hard feelings.
No. No hard feelings.
There, see?
Wounded Elk pointed at the tall figure leading three horses toward the cottonwoods upriver.
He is the one who killed Dead Man and Two Arrows. Look at the ponies he is leading. The spotted one is Dead Man's.
I see him.
Yellow Hand had not been with the war party that had attacked the white men on mules and had cost the lives of all but Wounded Elk and Crooked Lance. Crooked Lance had been the leader of that war party, but he was not with them today. Because of the loss of lives suffered, he was thought to be unlucky and he was not welcome on this scouting party. Yellow Hand had refused to give up the search for the men who killed his brother, insisting that only fools would try to cross over the mountains in the winter.
We must decide what is the best thing to do. It would not be wise to attack them since we are only four, and there is still too much snow to ride in quickly and drive off their horses and mules. They are camped close to the white man's village as well.
What are we going to do? Why have we traveled all this way if we are going to do nothing?
This is what I think. I think they are not going anywhere until the weather gets better. I think we should go back to our village and mount a full war party. With many warriors, we can kill all the whites. And with many warriors, the people in the white man's settlement will be afraid to come to help them. That is what I think.
Our village is a long way from this place. What if the white men have gone before we can get back?
The mountains are covered with snow. It will be another full moon before they are able to travel. There is plenty of time for us to return.
I agree also.
Red Sky was the youngest of the four.
But we could slip into their camp tonight and steal some of their horses.
It is better not to warn them to prepare against future attacks. You will have your chance to steal many horses and count coup many times if you have a little patience.
Not even the one man who led the ponies into the trees?
It's best not to take a chance that he might shout an alarm to the others. If he is the one who killed my brother, as Wounded Elk has said, then it is I who should have the right to kill him. When it is dark, then I'll look for him in the trees. If I can find him alone, I will kill him.
He's the one who killed Two Arrows. I saw him. He wasn't with the others when we found them by the river. He came from the mountain ridge behind us and shot Two Arrows and Dead Man. I was lucky to get away before he shot us all.
He doesn't look like the other white men in that camp. Maybe he is the ghost of the Blackfeet called Joe Fox, who they say walks along the high peaks of the mountains.
A ghost, eh? He didn't look like a ghost to me. Tonight, when it's dark, I'll find this ghost and kill him.
With no reason to believe that he was being stalked, Joe Fox climbed on the pane and struck out across the treeless slope.
Yep.
Although darkness was already descending over the valley, he decided to ride on until finding shelter at the base of the mountain beyond another treeless mesa. Covering the snow made traveling at night easy enough to see the breaks and gullies that might otherwise have hampered him. Consequently, he was in no particular hurry to get anywhere. The only urgency he felt was to remove himself from the people he was leaving behind. After he had ridden for a little over an hour, a light snow began to fall, creating a lacy veil over the dark form of the mountain directly before him now. He pulled the hood of his bearskin coat over his head and pressed on, oblivious to the falling snow. Though heavy on his mind, he decided to put away thoughts of Callie Simmons and her parents and bring his concentration back to what he knew best, survival. A long, deep ravine carved into the base of the mountain was his choice for a campsite. Sheltered from the icy winds by a thick growth of pines, The defile offered protection for his horses, as well as a little grass under a thick blanket of snow. Meanwhile, stealing cautiously across the open meadow, Yellow Hand, followed closely by his companions, made his way toward the cottonwoods that framed the river. Once they had reached the cover of the trees, they paused to look carefully around them. There was no sign of the man they searched for or the horses he led. There was, however, an easy trail in the snow that told them which way he had gone.
Do you still think this man is a ghost? These are tracks a child could follow. I don't believe ghosts leave tracks.
All we see here are tracks left by the ponies. The ponies are not ghosts. There are no tracks left by the man, so who can say?
We will see if this ghost sheds blood when I kill him. Come now.
When the trail left the trees and continued across the treeless hill, they stopped to speculate again.
He leaves the others. He goes back to his home in the mountains.
He cannot hide his trail in the snow. I'll track him down and kill him. My brother must be avenged.
We will follow him.
I am afraid if we go after this one man in the high mountains, it may take too long to catch him. If we are going to attack the white men in the holes by the river, we need to go back to our village and get our warriors ready. The white man is crazy. Who knows when they might decide to leave? They may not wait until the passes are clear.
There is wisdom in what Long Walker says. There is much preparation to ready our warriors for battle. This is something we should talk about.
Yellow Hand nodded and considered the comments. Although Wounded Elk sought to hide his reluctance to follow this ghost, Yellow Hand sensed his friend's apprehension.
You may be right, but I know what I must do. You and Long Walker should ride back to our village to prepare for the attack. Red Sky can go with me to kill Joe Fox.
It was agreed then. Long Walker and Wounded Elk started back on the long trek to the Grovon village, while Yellow Hand and the eager young Red Sky set out after the lone mountain man, the Blackfoot, called Joe Fox. The man they hunted was in the process of making his camp a little more weatherproof, thinking the ravine a good place to stay for a while before moving up to one of his regular camps by the waterfall. By the light of a full moon that broke through with the passing of the recent snow clouds, he selected a spot in a stand of young pines. Picking four of the young trees, he bent the tops over and tied them together, forming a crude shelter. Cutting branches from other trees, he covered his shelter, making it better able to protect him from the weather. His hut of pines also allowed him to make his fire inside, away from any eyes that might be about. By the look of the sky, there should be more snow on the way, possibly by morning. That should help cover the trail he'd left in the snow. When his camp was finished and his horses taken care of, he roasted some of the dried meat he carried. He couldn't help but think of the times Callie had brought him pan bread or some other thing she had cooked to eat with his jerky. As soon as the thought sprang forth, he forbade his mind to dwell on Callie Simmons. He'd wasted enough thoughts on foolish fantasies that couldn't be. He must walk the path that had been set before him and lead the white man to his own world. His self-counsel was not enough to ease his mind, however, and he became restless and ill at ease with a feeling that all was not well. He decided he needed to breathe the clean mountain air, free of the smoke from his fire. Taking his rifle, he left the hut and stood for a while listening to the sounds of the night. Looking above him, he saw a knob formed at the rim of the ravine where more young pines grew in a half circle. He decided to climb up to the knob to await the morning sun. It wouldn't be long before it rose. He'd labored all night. He felt the need to rest, but his restless feelings made the thought of sleep impossible. When he reached the knob of pines, he decided this would be a good place to watch the sun come up over the mountains. two Grovant warriors paused to study the trail that now led up a draw at the foot of the mountain. Yellowhand looked up at the sky.
It will be morning soon. I think he has decided to make his camp up this ravine.
Red Sky nodded. He was in agreement that if Joe Fox intended to climb the mountain, this draw was not a reasonable path to attempt. It went only for a quarter of the way up before ending at the base of a sheer cliff. With prospects of catching the mountain man while he was sleeping, they hurried along the trail, following it up the snowy drag, eager to reach the camp before sunup. Suddenly, Yellowhand held his hand up to halt Red Sky.
He has made a lodge with young trees. His horse is tied in the trees beyond. It will be light soon. We must hurry to be ready.
They crept forward until they reached a point some 30 yards from the pine shelter. There, they split up on either side of the trail in order to set up a crossfire. Yellowhand hoped to catch his enemy as he walked out of his shelter, so he waited until the sun had risen over the ridges to the east. Still, Joe Fox did not come out. Too impatient to wait any longer, he inched a few yards closer, then gave Red Sky the signal to shoot. After both men emptied the magazines of their rifles, they charged up to the shelter to peer inside. Stunned, they stood gaping at an empty hut.
Up here!
Joe examined the dead. He was able to identify him as Grovant and realized that they must have been seeking revenge for the slaying of their brothers. He'd been spared because of his feelings of restlessness. He also wondered whether the slight feeling of uneasiness he had experienced while making his camp had been caused by a sense of danger, as if something had been warning him. He did not discount it. It was a trait often manifested in wild animals, and like a wild animal, he had lived many years alone in the mountains. In the cave shelter of she and her parents, Callie Simmons slid the cake of pan bread off the huge iron skillet onto a folded cloth, since the bread was larger than any plate she had. She glanced up at her mother and smiled.
I'll bet Joe would appreciate a piece of this to go with his coffee.
I expect he might. But he's been living without it for most of his life, so I wouldn't bother taking him any. Our supplies are running low as it is without feeding every wild critter in the woods.
Mama, I can't believe you begrudge a little piece of bread for someone who's done so much for us.
Just forget about it, Callie. We think it best if you don't hang around someone like Joe Fox no more. Can't nothing good come from it.
And a lot of bad.
I don't know what's wrong with you two. Joe is the kindest, most thoughtful man I've ever met. He deserves a lot more than a little hunk of pan bread, and I'm taking it to him.
With that, she turned abruptly and left the cave. She ran headlong into Bradley Lindstrom as he was walking past their hovel.
Oof. Whoa, young lady. Where are you off to in such a hurry?
I'm sorry, Mr. Lindstrom. I should have been looking where I was going. I was going to take Joe some fresh pan bread if he's still in his camp.
Joe's gone.
Bradley glanced up to see Jake and Cora as they stepped outside after their daughter.
Gone? Did you say he was gone?
He said he was going to stay around for a few days, but he's already gone. Luke Preston's boy was over in those cottonwoods earlier this morning. There wasn't no sign of Joe, and he found tracks leading out toward the mountains to the south. What I'm afraid of, though, is if he's ever planning to come back, because we were sure hoping we could talk him into leading us to Oregon come spring.
Could be he's just gone hunting.
Well, don't look that way. He took his horses with him. All of them.
Well, I reckon there ain't nothing we can do about it. It's hard to depend on a man like that. Wild ones, you can never tell what they'll do.
I don't know. I hope he'll change his mind about going with us come spring. Well, I expect I'd best go see if my mules are doing all right.
Callie, honey, your pa and me were just trying to keep you from making a mistake that would ruin your whole life. And now You see, we were right about Joe Fox. He's gone without so much as a kiss my foot to anybody.
You said something to him, didn't you?
Callie, baby, it's best to forget that man. You're not ready to be making decisions that might affect the rest of your life.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
We're only thinking of you.
Oh, Mama! Why couldn't you just leave it alone?
Oof. Callie spun on her heel and stalked off toward the cottonwoods to be alone in her sorrow.
Maybe I ought to go after her.
Leave her alone. She's just hurting a little now, but she'll get over it. And she'll realize that she wasn't really in love after all.
One individual seemed to find the confrontation between mother and daughter amusing. Starbo watched Callie walk away in an apparent huff.
Oh, you can really swing that little behind of yours when you got your dander up.
Seated on his saddle blanket in the mouth of his cave, taking in the morning sun, he couldn't hear the conversation between Bradley and the Simmons family, except to catch a word or a phrase here and there when a voice was raised. It was enough to tell him that there was a thread of discord between daughter and parents, and it had something to do with Joe Fox. He drew satisfaction from anything that caused trouble for Jake Simmons or Joe Fox, and it was doubly pleasing to see something meant trouble for both of them. He was almost certain that he had heard Bradley Lindstrom tell Jake that Joe Fox was gone, and he hoped that was true. He hated Joe Fox as much as he had ever hated any man. More than that, although reluctant to admit it, he feared him. Feared the man's pragmatic reaction to threat. Starbo was dead certain that Joe Fox was about to finish him off that night he shot him in the shoulder, and he would have completed the job if the others had not persuaded him to stop. The thing that caused Starbo to fear the Rangy Mountain man was the cold, emotionless way he had prepared to kill him, with no show of excitement or anger, as if it were no more than the dispatching of a wounded animal. A man like that was dangerous. Given the chance, more specifically Joe Fox's back, Starbo wouldn't hesitate to kill him.
Lucky for him, he's gone.
Then he smiled when it occurred to his sluggish brain that with Joe Fox gone, there was no one to challenge him. His size and bluster would once again cause fear and demand respect. His smile widened. Before that morning, he had just about decided to leave this camp of God-fearing Bible thumpers and forget about going to Oregon. That $250 hidden in the little wooden box in Bradley Lindstrom's cave would give him a right comfortable grub stake for a while.
Yeah, maybe I'll go down to Butte. I don't nobody know me there. I'll just wait a little while longer for the weather to get better. It won't be no problem now that Joe Fox isn't around to track me when I leave with money.
Spring arrived early that year. Everyone in the camp was eager to vacate their dank, dark, earthen hovels and continue on to what they hoped would be their promised land. There was still some trepidation, for no one could know for sure when all the passes would become clear of snow and ice. So they waited, and the men talked about it, and everyone prayed together for guidance at the Sunday service. The one thing that dismayed Bradley was there was no sign of Joe Fox. He, Jake, and Raymond talked about the possibility of sending someone to find the reclusive mountain man. After much discussion, it was decided that the likelihood of finding Joe's camp was remote at best. So they prayed some more for some sign that it was safe to start out over the mountains, hoping God would send a message in some form, biblical or physical. A message was, in fact, on the way, but not the one the people were praying for. A war party numbering 23 Grovant warriors, plus 5 young boys eager to prove themselves in battle, went into camp less than 2 days from Missoula Mills. Wounded Elk sat down before the fire to confer with Long Walker and Little Buffalo.
I fear they are both dead, killed by Joe Fox.
It had been a full moon with no sign of Yellow Hand and Red Sky, when they should have returned to the village many days ago, unless they were not successful in killing the Blackfoot ghost.
I fear that their deaths might bring bad luck to our attack of the White Camp. What say you, Wounded Elk?
I think that we have 2 more of our brothers to avenge, Long Walker. I don't think their deaths could bring bad luck to our mission, because we do not go to attack Joe Fox. Our fight is to avenge the warriors killed by the white men with no wagons.
Little Buffalo and Long Walker considered what Wounded Elk had said, then agreed that his counsel was probably wise. With the exception of the 2 missing warriors, all the other signs had been favorable. The weather had been kind to them on the journey from their village, and they had made good time in reaching the Missoula Valley.
What should we do about the white man's settlement upriver from the people that live in the ground? We don't know how many there are, or if they will come to help the mole people.
I think if we follow my plan, we will kill the mole people and be gone before the whites at the trading post can come to help them. We should get to the camp before the sun comes up 2 more times.
As Wounded Elk had said, the Grovant war party reached the creek from which Yellow Hand had watched the white camp before. Wounded Elk halted his warriors there to wait out the night before the dawn attack. They would proceed from this point on foot, leaving 4 of the young boys to hold the horses. While they waited, the warriors applied new war paint and asked the man above to favor them in battle. When it was time, half of the war party followed the creek down to the river, then worked their way back up the river to be in position between the water and the bluffs, facing the cave openings. 2 of Wounded Elk's bravest warriors stole across the open meadow in the gray light before dawn to pull rails from the corral to create a hole to drive the livestock through. When the first rays of the sun inched across the isolated patches of old snow, the rest of the war party advanced toward the village of caves, slowly at first, then gradually gaining momentum as the sun showed its face. At almost the same time the shooting started, the horses and mules were stampeded through the gap. Flushed from their beds by the hellish sound of war cries and gunfire, the settlers grabbed for their weapons and raced out to defend their camp, only to be cut down by the warriors below the bluffs as they emerged from the caves. The attack was well planned, with the warriors by the river keeping the settlers pinned in their earthen barricades, while the rest of their war party charged up behind the caves. If all went as Wounded Elk planned, all the whites would be trapped in their holes in the ground. He had underestimated the tenacity of the white settlers to defend their families and possessions, however. The warriors below the bluffs found themselves with no real protective cover from the rifle fire coming from the cave. After the initial barrage, the besieged settled down to snipe at the Indians on the edge of the wall. Soon, due to an absence of effective cover, one by one, the Grovant casualties began to pile up until they were forced to withdraw down the river. Soon, the embattled settlers were able to vacate the caves and take up the fight behind them. The battle became a single front skirmish as the warriors from the riverbanks joined Wounded Elk and his warriors in the open field before the line of caves. Amid the heat of the conflict, Max Starbo at first cursed himself for not having left the mule train when he first had the notion. He had dallied too long on his decision to head for Butte. With no thoughts of helping defend his fellow travelers, he sought to escape the battle altogether, with priority being the preservation of his hide and the others be damned. but his greed would not permit him to go without the money in Nancy Lindstrom's little wooden box. It occurred to him then that the attack by Indians might have given him the perfect opportunity to liberate that money. The thought forced a smile to appear on his craggy face. Easing his bulk out of his cave, he made sure there were no Indians remaining below the bluffs before moving cautiously down the line of caves.
Come on, Starbolt, we got him on a run!
Right behind you!
The Indians were withdrawn and the men from the settlement were given chase.
Go get them, boys.
Then Starbolt turned his attention back to the row of caves. There was no one inside. He wasted no time in getting down to Bradley Lindstrom's cave, and without hesitating, he ducked inside. In a hurry, he went directly to the stack of pots and pans where he had first seen the wooden box. There it was, just as he had left it. He snatched it from the stack, opened it, and found the money still there.
Now, you can put that right back where you found it.
No.
Starbolt turned to find Nancy Lindstrom huddled against the back corner of the cave with a shotgun aimed straight at him.
Well, now, you just hold your horses, ma'am. This ain't what it looks like.
I think I know what it is.
Starbolt suddenly drew his pistol from his belt.
Tell your god I said hello, ma'am.
Starbolt trotted along toward the fighting in hopes he might find his horse. The counterattack had been spirited enough so that the raiding Indians had had no time to herd the horses and mules. Consequently, they were scattered along the river and over the open meadow. He would have struck out for Butte right then if he'd had his horse. He didn't care about the mules or most of the things he had packed on him. With the money, he didn't need the household items in those packs. He would have preferred to be gone when Nancy Lindstrom's body was found. But no one saw him, so he wasn't overly worried. There was no rejoicing over the successful defense of their mule train, for there had been lives lost. Immediately after the final retreat of the Grovon War Party, the weary settlers went about the business of recovering their livestock and mending the corral, with the unhappy task awaiting to bury their dead and comfort the survivors. Most of the victims were men cut down as they ran out of the caves in the initial assault. Some, like Nancy Lindstrom, were harder to explain. Nancy had been shot at close range, yet no one had reported seeing any Indians on top of the bluffs. It was just one of life's mysteries to a grieving husband, until he happened to find that the money was missing from the little wooden box. It was highly unlikely that an Indian had taken the money. Nothing else had been disturbed, so all suspicions went directly towards Starbolt, but there was no proof one way or the other. Bradley insisted upon facing the huge bully with the accusation anyway, and along with his brother Malcolm and several others, he called Starbolt out shortly after burying Nancy.
You're barking up the wrong tree, Lindstrom. I was fighting them damn Injuns alongside everybody else. You got a hell of a lot of nerve asking me about how your wife got killed. How the hell would I know? I might ought to break your back for you, throwing something like that up in my face. She probably got shot because you was someplace hiding from the Injuns.
I've asked around, Starbolt. Nobody remembers seeing you at all when we were driving those Indians across the meadow.
That ain't all of it, Starbolt. There's a little matter of $250 that's missing from Bradley's cave, and I'm thinking you're the one who most likely took it.
Malcolm, you son of a bitch! I'll kill you right now!
Starbolt dropped his hand to rest on his pistol and stopped only when he saw several rifles immediately bob up to a firing position.
I reckon I oughtn't to hold it against you. I mean, losing your wife and all. But I ain't the only sinner in this outfit. Could have been anybody, including the damn Injuns that stole that money. Now I'm letting you get away with it this time, Lindstrom. but I better not hear no more talk out of you about no stolen money. Now, go on and get the hell out of my face before I lose my temper.
You think you...
Not ready to concede, Bradley started toward the big man, but Malcolm and Raymond Chadwick caught him by his arm and pulled him away.
That's all we can do right now, Brad.
We got no way to prove it. What if we're accusing the wrong man?
That's right, Lindstrom. You better listen to him. You can't prove a damn thing, and if you keep running your mouth, you're liable to have to back it up.
Starbo shifted his gaze then to focus on Jake Simmons, and he grinned.
And there ain't no half-breed to save your ass this time.
We ain't done with this yet.
Still standing before Starbo, Raymond Chadwick took it upon himself to speak for the whole community.
I'm speaking for the congregation now, Starbo. We've done our best to give you every opportunity to salvage your Christian soul, but I reckon there's just some things that prayer won't change. So, we think it best if you go your own way now and let us go ours.
You're throwing me out? Oh, well, much as that sorrows me, I guess I will just go then. Hell, I'll leave first thing in the morning.
Starbo was right about the grieving widower. Bradley Lindstrom could not be consoled. Nancy had been his life, and he couldn't bear the thought of living without her. The despondent new widower slipped between the caves and walked along behind him to the end of the row and Starbo's dwelling. He paused a moment to consider the saddled horse and loaded pack mule tied to a pine sapling a few feet from the cave's entrance.
Starbo!
Who is it?
Starbo edged up to the opening and peered out in the gloom. Recognizing Bradley Lindstrom then, he guessed the reason for the visit. He remained at the edge of the opening with his huge body all but concealed.
What the hell do you want?
You know what I want. I want you to face me. I aim to kill you for murdering my wife.
I told you I never done it.
We both know that's a lie. Come on out of there and face me.
Yeah, you're right. I shot the bitch. I even thought about doing a little more, but a man would have to be damn hard up to want any of that.
Come on out of that cave and face me. The Lord will decide who shall survive.
Without further hesitation, Starbo stepped outside and raised the pistol he'd been hiding.
The Lord decided.
Starbo reached down then and took Bradley's revolver from the holster and placed it in the dead man's hand. Standing erect again, he turned to walk away, only to be startled by the sight of Callie Simmons standing paralyzed by the shock of what she had just witnessed.
Where the hell did you come from? You saw it. He tried to kill me, but I got him instead. It was self-defense.
You murdered him. He was just standing there, and you murdered him just like you murdered his wife.
Now that ain't so. Look at him. He's got a gun in his hand.
You put it in his hand after you shot him. I saw you.
Starbo rushed forward and grabbed her by the arm. He laid the barrel of his pistol across the back of her skull. He picked up the limp body and hurried to his horse. With one more look back to confirm that he'd not been spotted, he stepped up in the saddle and loped off along the creek, leaving the ill-fated mule train behind him.